beauty of His holiness and His righteousness today. Delight to see you here. We're especially glad to have Sister Evelyn Vitito back after several weeks of absence, and we've missed her a great deal. And then we have several visitors with us this morning that delight us. The theme of Romans is being right with God by faith, by trust. And that one word, faith or trust, says that our right relationship with God is not based upon something inherently good or grand about us, but we're looking beyond ourselves to God, and He is the source of our confidence. In the fourth chapter, Paul chooses a particular Old Testament character as an example of what it means to be justified by faith. And Abraham seems a long way off, nearly four millennia. And his situation and our own can seem awfully different as we try somehow to identify our own challenges, our own problems, our own needs with the situations that he faced so very long ago. But I believe it's not difficult at last if we think about it very much. For us to span those centuries and meet with Abraham at the point of common, desperate longing. Men haven't changed through the centuries. Their problems, their difficulties, their needs have not changed. And you can move a man along at 600-700 miles an hour in a jet airplane, but when he gets on the ground again, he's the same man facing the same problems that he had before he had that experience. And so, it's not far-fetched for us to consider Abraham as an example for us and as a model for us. Who was he anyway? Some of us in this audience may have little idea about Abraham. He was a man who lived in the ancient land between the Tigris and the Euphrates, the actual region where the Garden of Eden had been located, but of course, he lived there a long time afterward. Not quite two centuries before the birth of Christ, in a city called Ur of the Chaldees. He was a descendant of Shem, the son of Noah, one of the three who had escaped the judgment of God in the flood. But by the time he was born, his parents and evidently everybody around him had ceased to know very much about the true God. And they were worshiping idols of various kinds, gods of their own imaginings. At least later on, Joshua will say, you're going to have to choose whether you're going to serve Jehovah or you're going to serve the gods beyond the river that your father served. And had reference to Abraham's father and mother, grandfather, grandmother. But Abraham left that land because God called him out. He was just like the rest, evidently. Until God manifests himself to him in ways that we are not always told. And Abraham chose to follow. And as a consequence of that, he became the father of a nation that is, I suppose, the most significant nation in human history in terms of God's redemptive purposes, saving all of us. And that was the nation that came to be known as the nation of Israel. Interestingly enough, it wasn't named after Abraham. It's named after his grandson, who had 12 sons, and each of those sons became the head of a tribe. And so they became the 12 tribes of Israel. And Israel was the name that God gave to Jacob, who was born to Isaac, and Isaac was born to Abraham. So that always in the Old Testament, God identifies himself to the nation that was his in a special way. He said, I am the God of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob. And all the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were the fulfillment of a promise that God made to this man. All Jews have still, had then, a special reverence for Abraham because he was their common father. He was a hero. He was the one who, by his trek through the wilderness, coming down into the region of Canaan, he became the progenitor of everything that they had and everything that they hoped for. But the problem was, that although they revered Abraham and they revered Moses, they didn't understand either one of them. There was no way you could mention the name of Abraham in the presence of a Jewish audience that they wouldn't all square their shoulders and sit up straight. And you couldn't mention Moses without them throwing out their chests with a certain pride. But Jesus indicates to us in conversation that he had that it wasn't always easy to get these descendants of Abraham to understand the man that they revered. In the 8th chapter of the Gospel of John, Jesus had a conversation with some men who were supposed to be believers in him, and in some very shallow, superficial way they were. But it becomes evident that their faith is of little consequence. In verse 37, "I know that you are Abraham's seed, yet you seek to kill me because my word hath not free course in you. I speak the things which I have seen with my father, and you also do the things which you have heard from your father." They answered and said to him, "Our father is Abraham." Jesus said to them, "If you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham." In other words, bloodline don't mean a thing. You don't have any kinship with Abraham at all. You don't understand Abraham. You don't understand what made him tick. And for sure, what made him tick is not what makes you tick. Now, there's another problem, too, as expressed in the 9th chapter about Moses. That man who was born blind and whom Jesus set free from his blindness at the Pool of Siloam. And the Pharisees were just hard-pressed to accept the fact that Jesus could have done such a thing, that there wasn't some sort of chicanery afoot. And so, finally, in verse 25, when they had constantly pressed him to say that Jesus was a sinner and he knew he was a sinner, and why didn't he admit he was a sinner? He therefore answered, "Whether he is a sinner, I know not." I believe there's a bit of irony in this. "One thing I know, that whereas I was blind, now I see." And they said therefore unto him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" And he answered them, "I told you even now, and you did not hear. Wherefore would you hear it again? Would you also become his disciples?" And they reviled him and said, "Thou art his disciple, but we are disciples of Moses. We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, we know not whence he is." To which he replies, "It's a marvel to me you don't know where he is from, in view of the fact that never in the history of the world has a man who has been born blind had his eyes recovered to him again, and you don't understand who he is." In the 5th chapter of John, he says in verse 45, Jesus speaking to the Jews that are giving him all kinds of difficulty, he says, "Think not that I will accuse you to the Father. There is one that accuses you, even Moses, on whom you have set your hope. For if you believe Moses, you would believe me, for he wrote of me. But if you believe not his writings, how shall you believe my word?" So the point of it all is that although they gloried in their heroes, they never understood them. And it wasn't the fault of God. They just never wanted quite to perceive exactly what the basis of the standing of these men with God was. But in the 4th chapter of Romans, Paul chooses Abraham as an example of justification by faith, how to be righteous with God. Now you might say, why did he choose Abraham instead of Moses? Moses was the lawgiver, and he was certainly a heroic figure, because the purpose of this particular illustration in Romans 4 is to demonstrate that a man could be just with God, right with God, and not be circumcised. It was inconceivable, I can tell you, in the mind of a Jew, that anybody could be right with God if he wasn't circumcised. Now, a Gentile might be right with God. Someone who is not a Jew might be right with God, but only if he would come and be circumcised and keep the law. And Paul's writing to people who are convinced that the only way in the world you can be right with God is to keep his law and to be in yourself righteous, to have worth within yourself that would be of such a nature that you could step up to God and say, I've come for what I deserve. I've come for what's owed me. I've come for what I'm due. And Paul has already, in the first three chapters of this epistle, demonstrated that you better not try that. You better not ask God for what you do. Because what we'll do as a consequence of the universality of our transgression against His will, nobody is an exception. All have sinned and come short of the glory of God. So what we'll do if we step up and ask for justice is condemnation and the wrath of God upon us. And you don't want that, he said. I don't want it. The thought of asking God what I deserve chilled my bones. But he said there is a way of being right with God that's not based upon you. And to demonstrate to you that I'm not preaching some strange kind of doctrine that the Bible knows nothing about, something contrary to the whole system you learned in Moses, something contrary to the Old Testament, something contrary to everything that's been a part of your lives from the very beginning. I want to take your hero. I want to take the father of the nation, and I want to demonstrate to you that he wasn't justified by works of righteousness either. That he wasn't justified by circumcision. And so he opens, what then shall we say? That Abraham our forefather hath found according to the flesh. For if Abraham was justified by works, he hath whereof to glory. He could boast. If I'm righteous in myself, if I've never committed a single transgression of the will of God, there is no question that I have the right to stand before Him and expect to receive all that righteousness deserves. But in this case, Abraham does not have any right to glory toward God. Not in this situation. For what saith the Scripture? And Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned to him for righteousness. Now that particular passage is found in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 6. And in the passage that is being cited, it was a scene when Abraham, well, sometimes science fails. All right. Just have to get back to the old ways. It was a situation in which Abraham and Sarah found themselves down in the land of Canaan. And they didn't have any children. And he had left and come to this land. He didn't know a thing in the world about. Hadn't even checked out the real estate. Because God told him to go there. And he would bless him by making him the father of a great nation. Now that was the central promise that he made to Abraham personally. And they didn't have a single child. In fact, the only person who could have inherited anything he had in his house was Eliezer, his servant. And the 15th chapter of Genesis, he says, Eliezer is my heir. He's the only one I've got. I still don't have any children. And God said, you will have children. You will have children and descendants that are more numerous than the sands of the sea or the stars of heaven. And then he again renews the covenant with Abraham there in that particular chapter. And the Scripture says, Abraham believed God. And it was reckoned to him, accounted to him for righteousness. So what we're dealing with here is faith on the part of Abraham. And God reckoning to him, not because he was righteous, but God reckoning his faith for righteousness. And the point at which this is said is at Genesis 15:6, but the passage in Romans that we're looking at is Romans chapter 12, verse 3. Now, somebody looking at that particular part of Abraham's life may be disposed to say, well, what did he do? I want to know what he did. Why did God count that for anything? He just sat there. Well, that's what he did. The 11th chapter of Hebrews said that if he was mindful, he could have gone back to the country that he left. The evidence that he believed God was that he stayed down here in this trackless waste, where he didn't own a foot of ground, and where he didn't have a child. and kept on trusting God. That was the manifestation of it. But the problem that we're dealing with here is to demonstrate that this happened before Abraham was circumcised. Now, the reason Paul didn't choose Moses as his illustration is because Moses was circumcised the eighth day. And he, whatever he did in circumcision. And Paul is intent here on demonstrating that it was possible to be justified outside of that, without circumcision. And so he asked the question in the course of this particular study. Verse 9, is this blessing then pronounced upon the circumcision or upon the uncircumcision also? For we say to Abraham, his faith was reckoned for righteousness. How then was it reckoned? When he was in circumcision or in uncircumcision? Not in circumcision, but in uncircumcision. 15th chapter of Genesis. If you read Genesis, you'll find it's in the 17th chapter of Genesis that circumcision is first administered to Abraham and to his household. So this is before he was ever circumcised. You mean God justified a man and received a man into fellowship when he's uncircumcised? Well, that's horrendous. That's like accepting the Gentiles, the heathen, the dogs, the ones that are outside the people of the Lord. And that's exactly the point Paul is making. He has said in the first chapter, verse 16, as he stated his theme, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God unto salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. And so it's what is your hero. Remember now, your hero was just, was right with God by faith when he wasn't circumcised. But I want to make this point because I think there is a general tendency to say that's when it happened. That's when he was justified, ever after judged. That's the single dramatic event that made him right with God, and that secured that relationship as long as he lived, and that was it. One fell swoop, one striking dramatic act, and it's all over. It's done. Now, that's not what this chapter teaches. And that's not how you are justified by faith. If you have the thought today that you can do one heroic thing, that you can choose to invest yourself in one special way in a lifetime, and that just secures your relationship with God, then that's not so. And I believe I can prove that by taking this very chapter and demonstrating it. If you look at chapter 4, verse 13, for not through the law was the promise to Abraham or to his seed that he should be the heir of the world, but through the righteousness of faith. I want to go back. I'll use Romans 4, 13. And how in the world did I put that up? Well, I'm just a genius, that's all. All right. Romans 4:13 is a reference point, and I want us to go to the 11th chapter of Hebrews and look at a statement that is made there about the event that began this whole enterprise when God first called Abraham. We think to ourselves, what was Abraham doing all the time before this event? When he'd already done it, this the first time he ever believed in God? Is this the first time he ever trusted him? Is this the first time he ever acted in confidence that God would take care of him? The answer to that is no. Hebrews chapter 11, look at verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed to go out into a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out not knowing where he went. When God said to Abraham, you leave this country. I know your people are here, and I know this is where you grew up, and I know you know this place, or like the back of your head. And these are familiar regions. But I want you to leave all this and go to the place that you've never seen. But I'm telling you, it'll be a blessing if you do that. You haven't seen it. And all you have for it is my word. And Abraham believed God. He acted in faith. And that's the reason he was made an heir of the world. Now that's the promise in Romans, I'm sorry, Genesis 12, verse 3. He says, I will make you the father of a great nation, and in you shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. He made him the heir of the world. All the nations are going to be blessed through you. And it was at the time that he made that promise, the first time in Romans 12, that in Genesis 12, that Abraham believed. His faith started there. It had its genesis there. But it didn't stop there. And I want to say something else too. There's no indication that he just took a vacation from faith all the time between this point and this one. Between the time he left Ur of the Chaldees until he's down there in the land, doesn't have a child, and says, I don't have any heir. What am I going to do? And God says, I'm going to take care of that. And Abraham said, all right. There's no indication that Abraham was just sort of cruising along on his own notions. Now let's take another case out of Romans 4 that's illustrated out of another part of Abraham's life. We can start reading in verse 18. And this has reference to the time when he was 99 years old and Sarah was 90. Now you try to comprehend this. Somebody said those are different times. Well, they must not have been. It must not have been ordinary for a woman 90 years old to give birth to a child, even in the days of Abraham. And when Sarah was told she was going to have a child, she laughed about that. She denied it, but the Lord said you did laugh. And Abraham was put to the test to believe such a thing. Now remember, he was 70-something when he left Ur of the Chaldees. And now he's 99 and there's no child. And the scripture says in verse 18, who in hope believed against hope, to the end that he might become a father of many nations, according to that which had been spoken, so shall thy seed be. And without being weakened in faith, he considered his own body now as good as dead, he being about 100 years old, and the deadness of Sarah's womb. Yet looking to the promise of God, he wavered not through unbelief, but waxed strong through faith, giving glory to God, and being fully assured that what he had promised he was able also to perform. Wherefore also it was reckoned to him for righteousness. Here it is again. We have got another passage here in verse 23. Abraham looking to God, wanting to trust in him. And so when in Romans 4:23, we're looking at another occasion when Aaron was born. Aaron. This is a bad morning for me with getting a name. On the occasion when Isaac was born. And so we've come a ways since then. We've come clear past that over to the 17th chapter of Genesis. And Abraham is still believing God and still trusting him. Still having confidence in him. So this is an ongoing procedure. If we'd had the idea that back there in Genesis 15:6, it was all going to be over, there was not going to be anything more for Abraham to do, no other test for him to face. It's just a situation where things were taken care of. Then we've misunderstood exactly what Paul is saying here in this particular passage. And so here he was justified by faith. He was justified by faith. He was justified by faith. And it's not over yet. We can take you to another passage and demonstrate the fact that this statement in Genesis 15:6 is still in process of fulfillment. If you will, go to James chapter 2 and look at this passage. James is demonstrating the nature of faith. He's not talking about works. He's talking about faith, and he's talking about how faith works, what it does. And in verse 21, he says, was not Abraham our father justified by works, in that he offered up Isaac his son upon the altar? Thou seest that faith wrought with his works, and by works was faith made perfect. And the scripture was fulfilled which saith, and Abraham believed God, and it was reckoned unto him for righteousness. Now there's that passage again. There's that passage again, and now we're clear over to Genesis 22. And from James
chapter 2, we are seeing another affirmation that Abraham believed God and it was reckoned to him for righteousness. Now, what's being said here? That Abraham went on believing. He was walking in faith. It was a walk of faith. And God went on accounting him righteous as he went on believing. It was an existential thing. Moment by moment and day by day, Abraham went on trusting God. And as he trusted God, God went on accounting him righteous before him. Now you can see in all this that the kind of faith Abraham had was not just a tip of the hat, and we sure know you're up there, and I sure do believe in God, and it sure is wonderful that you're there. What you see in Abraham is a response that has concrete manifestation. He leaves the land and doesn't even know where he's going. Let me tell you, that's how you're going to begin if you want to be a Christian. There's some of us that contemplate being a Christian, and we say, well, I'm willing to consider that. But I want you to tell me just exactly what's going to happen now down the road here. I want you to give me the complete scenario. Just tell me what I'm going to be expected to do, what might happen to me, and what difficulty I might get in. And let me think about this a while. You're not going to be told that. The Lord alone knows. You do know you must commit yourself to Him, absolutely. That is to say, you must trust your life to Him. You must trust the direction of your life to Him. Abraham went out not knowing where he was going. You're going to do the same. You will not know what difficulties face you ahead. What burdens may come, what challenges may confront you. What you know is that when they come, God will take care of you. And what do you have to establish confidence in that? Only His promise. That's all you have. Only the promise of God. To be a Christian is to believe the promise of God, that God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in Him should not perish but have everlasting life. It is to believe the truth of the Great Commission, go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He that believeth and is baptized shall be saved. How do you know that's the way it's going to be? God said it would be that way. Well, what's the basis of my confidence? How can I be guaranteed? Only by faith. You can lay hold of this only by faith. You're going to have to make the commitment and let God take care of you. When you know it's right. When you know He's the only one that can take care of you anyway. When you recognize that there's no hope any other way. That if you don't have a right relationship with God, everything else becomes impossible and meaningless. Then you know what you've got to do. You got married, many of you. And you went out not knowing where you were going, too, didn't you? Did you have it written down that after 5 years we'll have our first child, and then the child be totally healthy and no problems, and then after this I'll get a better job, and we won't have any difficulties of this sort or that sort, and the wife and I, the husband and I, will not have any challenges in our relationship? Is that the basis on which you did it? It was an act of faith. You pledge to each other that this is the way it's going to be, for better or for worse. And there have been a lot of surprises along the way sometimes. But the commitment's the same. But when we think about God, this is how we must begin our walk with Him. We must trust Him utterly. Put our confidence in Him. That's what. What's meant here by justification, righteousness, by faith, by trusting God, putting our confidence in Him. And the evidence of our confidence is evidence in the way we behave, in the way we live. And so it was all the way through. I think about this final occasion. You go through the life of Abraham. And by the way, as you look at this life that I've sort of described in a very truncated way here with four instances out of the whole of it, and that certainly does not give expression to the whole of Abraham's faith, nor the whole of God having counted him righteous. But it tells us a lot, and as we look at it, I know as I'm looking at it that Abraham wasn't always right about everything. He is the father of the faithful. He was a trusting individual. He put his confidence in God. But there are lapses. Remember the time, the 12th chapter of Genesis, when he went down to stay in Egypt for a while? And you know what he told the Pharaoh? He told the Pharaoh that his wife was his sister. And she was his sister. She was his half-sister. Half so. Of course, the most important truth to be understood here was that she was his wife, because Pharaoh was looking at her in that way and took her into his own harem. That wasn't right. And then there was another occasion in the 20th chapter of Genesis when he did the same thing with Abimelech, prince of the Philistines, when he went down there for a time during the famine. That wasn't right. And particularly, I think about the 16th chapter when he and Sarah decided just after this event, when he believed God and was reckoned him for righteousness, but in the next chapter, they are busily engaged in figuring out how they will get a son. Since Sarah could not have one, she said, "You take Hagar, my handmaid." And it has been demonstrated through archaeological finds that this was a common practice in that day when your wife could not bear a child. And they just followed the common practice, and she said, "You take my handmaid here, Hagar, and have a child." And you know, Hagar was with child by Abraham. And you know more than that, it was born healthy. And you know more than that, it was a boy. Everything was turning out just right. The only problem was, it was not according to the will of God. And God refused. Oh, Abraham said, "Please, let Ishmael live before you. Let him be my heir. I don't have any other. Let him be my heir." And God said, "No, Sarah shall have a child. I told you that. Sarah shall have a child." What was his weakness here? He started working things out by his own wisdom and strength. It wasn't the same spirit that caused him to drop everything and leave Ur of the Chaldees without a thought. It wasn't the same spirit that caused him to stay right there in that land, although he had no child and no prospects so far as any concrete evidence was concerned. It certainly was not the spirit of the Mount of Moriah. But that wasn't characteristic of Abraham. That was a glitch. That was a step aside. The attitude and disposition of Abraham's life was an attitude of faith and of confidence and of direct commitment to the Lord. And nothing in all that's said about him more demonstrates that fact than that story told in the 22nd chapter of Genesis. I don't know how old Isaac was by this time, but he had to be the delight of his mother, her only child. And by the way, one that, though God had said she was going to have and she had hung on, it just looked like an absolute impossibility. You can imagine how dear to Sarah this boy was. And you can imagine, too, what he meant to Abraham emotionally. This was Sarah, his beloved son. It was his son. It was the son God gave. This precious son, and in a great measure, the only son. Because it's by Isaac that your seed will be called. It's in Isaac that the promise will be fulfilled. It's in Isaac that you'll be the father of a great nation. And God says to him early one morning or whenever the time was, he said, "You take Isaac, your son, up to the mountains of Moriah, and you offer him as a burnt offering." Can you imagine the kind of challenge, the emotional challenge? Take this boy away and kill him? The moral challenge? If it hadn't been God saying this, there's no way you could kill somebody. Kill your own child. But of course, God has the right over all our lives. And God is saying it. But that's a challenge. And a challenge more than anything else to his faith. If I kill this boy, then how will God fulfill his promise to me? And I have been down in this land for these endless years for no other purpose than the fact that I'm going to be the father of a great nation. And if I kill this boy, it's all over. And he got up early in the morning, got some firewood, and took along a coal of fire or something. And with his servants and with that lad, they started out for the mountain of Moriah. And when they got there, I don't suppose that ever a human being had a harder question to answer than the one that Isaac put to his father. He said, Father, and you can feel the ingenuousness of this lad, the ingenuousness of the lad. He's just asking a question out of curiosity. He said, here's the wood, and here's the fire, but where's the sacrifice? And it must have been out of the deep recesses of his faith. At a moment that was so burdened by pain, that Abraham answered. He said, my son, the Lord will provide for himself a sacrifice. How would you have answered? And he took that lad up on top of the mountain and stretched him out. How would you have looked in his eyes and raised an eye above his bosom? And there could have been no doubt in the heart of that lad that his father intended to take his life. And God stayed his hand. Now what the Genesis account says is, now I know thou fearest me, seeing thou hast not withheld thy son, thine only son, from me. Now I know. Now we may not grasp the full implication of that, but God said, I didn't know that till this moment. Well, didn't he know? Yes, there's evidence of it here. And again and again and again and again. But we must continue to demonstrate throughout our lifetime that we believe in God. And it will cost us various prices as we come to crossroads that life presents to us. And we will have to decide whether we're going to go God's way or ours. And I believe every day is characterized by those kinds of decisions. We must decide, are we going to go God's way or ours? Or are we going to trust Him, or are we going to trust ourselves? And every day is decided whether we're going to be trusting and faithful and whether we're going to be counted righteous with Him or not. Now, some people, to explain all these instances when Abraham believed God and was accounted him for righteousness, they've figured it out by saying that Abraham's faith in Genesis 15:6 was not fulfilled until his obedience in Genesis 22. So that finally, here's when it was all fulfilled. He was not justified till this. What's the problem with that? That ruins Paul's argument. Because in Genesis 22, Abraham was circumcised. And that's not what he's saying. Our Calvinist friends, and I love them, I just believe they're wrong. Critically wrong. Their idea is that Abraham was justified before men here. They say, no, right here he was justified at this point. Forever justified. And he couldn't be lost ever. So that there could not be any repetition of that. There was no need of a repetition of that. Right here is the critical moment. So Genesis 22 is just the time when he was declared just before men. The only problem about it, there's not anybody to hear it. The young men are left behind. He takes Isaac with him. And Isaac doesn't know what's going on. Except he's about to be sacrificed. What are you going to teach Isaac? And then there's the fact that God says, now I know. Now I know. Thou fearest me. You say, didn't he know that Abraham... You argue that all you want to. The text of Genesis says it in plain language. Now I know. That's how fear is me. So what is this saying to us? Let's just wrap this up and we'll let you have this lesson. And I'll quit stumbling over my names and words and things like that, proving my fallibility. That you won't be justified by faith like Abraham was, then you just have to live a life of faith. Well, can I do just one great heroic thing and it's all over? No, you can't do that. Well, couldn't you just assign me some really difficult task that it's really tough to do, and let me do that, and I'll be done with it, and I'll have my life insurance paid up for the whole time, and we won't have to face that. No, you cannot. You're going to have to live your life from here to there. And the whole of it is going to have to be characterized by a disposition always to do God's will and to pay any price and to involve yourself in any sacrifice to accomplish it.
And many times you're going to meet your own mountain of Moriah when something dear and precious to you is being demanded in order for you to be faithful to God. And it's not going to be easy to do that. Perhaps I'm not talking about something in prospect. Perhaps you already know what I'm talking about. But we have to decide that day and that hour whether or not we love and trust and cherish God more than anything. Because if we're going to be counted righteous, if we're going to be acceptable to Him, it's going to have to be because we go on trusting in Him day after day after day. And it's to be expected that the Lord would increase the level of demand. He's patient with us. He does not take the young follower and put the heavy load on him at the outset. All he asks at the first is, trust me. Give yourself to me. Make the commitment to me. And in this particular case, in this age of the gospel, we are called upon to put our confidence in God by believing in His Son. Jesus Christ is Lord. That's the commitment that we must make. That's the confession we must make. Romans 10:9. Except you believe that I am He, you will die in your sins. That's clear enough. From John 8:24. It's either trust my Son or be lost. You're going to have to pay the just penalty for your transgressions if you don't come into the faith of Christ. If you don't seek my mercy, if you don't seek a righteousness that comes by trusting me and what I have done for you. I sent my Son on your behalf. Will you trust that sacrifice for you? Will you accept that gift of mine for your own reconciliation with me or not? That's the thing we must make at the beginning. It has got to be a wholehearted commitment like Abraham's one. But then it's going to be tested throughout our life. We made the promise. Now, how serious was our commitment? Will we get down here at peace and decide that price is too high? I hadn't anticipated this. I didn't think it's going to be this hard. I believe I'll just go back to Ur of the County where they got running water down there. Don't have to dig wells. Then you're going to lose everything. You might have been right with God at a given point because you were trusting in Him and you were believing in Him. But that's been terminated because you've come to a new crossroads and you decided you want to go the way opposite to faith, the way opposite to trust, to believe in yourself, to walk in the light of your own eyes and after the counsel of your own wisdom. And that ruins everything. It's day to day, moment by moment, that we are right with God because we trust Him. And the question that I want you to ask, and I want to ask myself this morning, is, do I believe Him? No. What did I do yesterday or the day before? Because that's past. But do I believe Him now? Am I believing Him? Am I trusting Him? And do I manifest that trust by doing what He tells me to do? Well, then if I'm doing that, if I've set my heart to do that, if that is the purpose of my life, let me tell you something. I'm right with God. Well, somebody says, why? Because you have this tremendous faith, this wonderful faith, this grand faith, this heroic faith. Because God, in whom I trust, is gracious and merciful and forgiving and patient to those that set their heart to do His will, to those that put their trust in Him. Remember, Abraham wasn't perfect. He wasn't sinful. But he had a perfect faith. He had a perfect commitment to God to do His will and always turn from his folly back to the Lord. And that was characteristic of his life. And it can be characteristic of yours, but of mine. But if you have not been baptized into Christ, you haven't left Ur of the Chaldees yet. You haven't gone out not knowing where you are going, but knowing you are following the Lord and doing His will. And so we urge upon you this morning, if you're not a Christian, never having committed your life to the Lord, never having confessed that Jesus Christ is Lord before men, that you do that. And walk like Abraham walked through. Have what he had. And if as a Christian you began But now you've wandered all over the map. You've let everything under the sun carry you away little by little and bit by bit, and you have seen the spiritual life drain out of you like a slow leak. By the way, you want to watch that. Spiritual disaster usually is not a blowout, it's a slow leak. Then just say, I'm through with that. I'm going to serve the Lord and be right with Him and have the confidence that it gives you and the assurance and the joy that it brings. That's what I want. I want what Abraham had. I want what Paul says Abraham had and what all men can have if they trust in Him and do His will. It's yours this morning. Just for seeking and asking it, according to His will, while we stand together and sing.